You are listening to Girl Speak, a podcast series all about art, history, and contemporary culture with a girl's eye view.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 125 of Girl Speak, First Girls, the Early Administrations. I'm Sophie Small, a junior girl of Girl Museum. Thanks for tuning in, streaming, or downloading us today. Girl Speak is produced by Girl Museum, the first and only museum in the world dedicated to celebrating girlhood. Girl Museum explores the art, history, and culture of girls around the world in the past and present. All of our programmes are volunteer-run and supported by listeners like you. Special thanks to our sisterhood patrons, Angela Mills, Christine Kearney, Christina Susan Martinez, Elizabeth Dillenberg, Erica Holt, Frances Helt, Hilary Rose, Mary Celeste Kearney, Michelle Taylor Bucock, and Sophie. Visit us on the web at www.girlmuseum.org. Today's episode is all about first girls. You've likely heard of first ladies, the wives and partners of US presidents. Unfortunately, we're yet to see any first gentlemen, but officially and unofficially, the White House has seen its first share of first girls, the daughters of presidents, who take on life at the centre of US politics, hosting dignitaries, dealing with the media, supporting their fathers, and even leading international delegations. These girls are often left out of the history books, but their role has been crucial to US political life right from the start. These girls have grown up in the presidential spotlight, giving them a unique role and perspective within its formation. Today, we're going to focus on the earlier administrations. We'll look at first girls from Nellie Park Custis through to Alice Neville Roosevelt. As we go through their stories, we can see how the role of the president's family developed, alongside the challenges of wider society in the 18th and 19th centuries. In 1789, George Washington was elected as the first president of the United States. He served two full terms and established the office that would be followed by his successors. He had no children of his own, but had married his wife Martha after she was widowed, and had helped to raise her children, John and Patsy. After John's death during the Siege of Yorktown, they also helped to raise her grandchildren, bringing the youngest two, Eleanor and George, to live with them at Mount Vernon. When Washington became president, his granddaughter Eleanor Park Custis, known as Nellie, was 10 years old. The term First Lady was not used at this time, but as Washington's role developed, Martha began to host affairs of state at what was known as the Republican Court. Nellie helped to entertain her guests at the presidential mansions, acting as the very first of our first girls. Martha and Nellie established the precedent that's followed to this day, taking up duties that at the time were amongst the very few considered appropriate for upper-class women. Hosting social gatherings, organising cultural events, and, crucially, managing relationships between members of the new government. Today, this kind of work is recognised as a form of soft power, essential to maintaining control and influence. At age 19, Nellie married one of Washington's nephews. Like the rest of her family members, she was a slave owner. Upon her marriage, and upon the deaths of her mother and of Martha, Nellie inherited slaves and plantations. She and her husband ran plantations both on the Mount Vernon estate and in Clark County. While Nellie and her family set a precedent that still impacts society today, the democracy they worked for was greatly limited, functioning only because it profited from the labour of those it oppressed. Eleanor Park Custis Lewis died in 1854 at the age of 75. She had eight children of her own, of whom three survived to adulthood. She had also lived to see 14 different presidents take office. The next three presidents, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and James Monroe, all had daughters who had grown up and married before they took office. Their daughters, Abigail Adams, Mary and Martha Jefferson, and Eliza Monroe, were hugely influential in American politics and culture as writers, trendsetters, and figures of celebrity. Eliza gets a special mention in this podcast because of the way she has been characterised through history. She had spent her childhood in Paris when her father was the US Minister to France. She was schooled and socialised amongst many girls from European royal families, including Hortense de Beauharnais, the future mother of Napoleon III. Her connections gave her a strong understanding of how to manage a court and maintain hierarchy. During her father's presidency, she acted as an unofficial first lady on account of her mother's ill health. She was reported to be snobbish, difficult to work with, and to have a serious influence over her father. As recently as 1992, Jack Mitchell, in his book on White House scandals, described Eliza as a difficult snob and a society bitch. Reportedly, George Washington grew so tired of her and her mother's strict social etiquette that he instituted a boycott of the Monroe women. It's hard, several hundred years later, to be sure of Eliza's motivations, but it seems that there may be more to that story. Powerful women throughout history have been derided as snobbish and bitchy, while men are judged more favourably for the same behaviour. This early first girl may have been more effective than she's given credit for. Monroe served as president for two full terms, and maintained a relatively peaceful administration despite tense factions emerging in US politics throughout the period. In later life, Eliza returned to France and entered into a Catholic convent. She is buried at the famous Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. Two large families followed the Monroes into the White House. William Henry Harrison was president for only 31 days, from March 4th to April 4th, 1841, when he died of a fever. He and his wife had had 10 children, but by the time he took office, only four were still alive, including three daughters, Elizabeth, Mary, and Anna. All three were adults by 1841, and all three were dead by 1846. The other child, John, was the only one of their children to make it to middle age, and in fact became president himself in 1889. The next family in the White House were just as large. In fact, the 10th president, John Tyler, fathered more children than any other president so far, a grand total of 15, seven of whom were daughters. Four of these girls, Mary, Letitia, Elizabeth, and Alice, were alive when he became president in 1841. Tyler's wife, Letitia, died a year into his presidency. After this, their second daughter, Letitia Tyler Semple, whose marriage was reportedly an unhappy one, took over as the White House hostess. This role may have provided a way for her to return to her family and continue a life separate from her husband. In 1844, John remarried. He and his second wife, Julia Gardner, had a further seven children between 1846 and 1860. Unfortunately, Mary had died in 1848, and both Elizabeth and Alice died at the age of 27, Elizabeth in childbirth and Alice of colic. So Letitia, who survived until 1907, was the only one of the original sisters to meet their youngest sibling, Paul. Regardless of wealth and status, the 19th century was a perilous time, when many children did not survive infancy, and many adults died young from disease, and especially complications from childbirth. There are no doubt more first girls of whom we've never heard, children that died young and were not well recorded, and pregnancies that ended in miscarriage or stillbirth. Our histories are incomplete, and those stories which we do have are all the more important because of this. The next girl in our series was already 18 when her father Millard Fillmore became president. Mary Fillmore, known as Abby, spoke multiple languages and played the piano, harp, and guitar. She taught in schools in Buffalo before her father took office. Her mother, Abigail Powers, had a recurring ankle injury and generally poor health, so while she was greatly admired as the White House hostess, she often entrusted her duties to her daughter. Abby performed as a musician at a range of White House functions, and no doubt made use of her studies and linguistic skills. After her father's presidency ended, her mother soon died, and she took over management of his household and accompanied him to public functions. But Abby herself died suddenly from cholera at age 22. She had never married or had children. After her death, her father did return to politics, without her at his side. Who knows what she might have done if she'd lived. In many ways, the next first girl, Nellie Grant, was the first to be publicly recognised in the role. Her full name was Ellen Renshaw Grant, but she was known throughout her life as Nellie. She was 13 when her father Ulysses S. Grant became president in 1869, and as she went through her teenage years, Nellie was very much in the public eye. At this young age, and with her healthy mother still alive, Nellie did not take on the duties of a White House hostess. Instead, her father attempted to keep her out of the limelight. At first, he sent her away to Miss Porter's School, an elite girls' boarding school in Connecticut. Nellie sent such distressed-sounding telegrams back to her father that he relented and had her escorted back to Washington. In Washington, she took full advantage of the social opportunities, reportedly shocking wider society by dancing all night at a ball. When she turned 16, her father, concerned at the number of suitors pursuing her, sent her away again, this time to England, with carefully chosen chaperones. In England, Nelly was received by Queen Victoria and attended many garden parties and events. For the press, here was a famous young woman with an exciting social life. We know little of Nelly's own thoughts on being sent away from Washington, but the focus of both American and British press shows that Nelly had become a true celebrity. She was perhaps not entirely at home in England, though. Queen Victoria described Nelly as rather stiff and offhand in her manner, commenting that she spoke with a great twang. On her way back to the US, Nelly met Algernon Sartress, an Englishman from the minor aristocracy and heir to the wealth of several famous family members. Despite her father's reluctance, Nelly became engaged to Sartress, and they married in a lavish White House ceremony in 1874, when she was 18. The wedding was full of every luxury, from orange blossoms brought up from Florida to a train bedecked in British and American flags which took the newlyweds away to New York. The glamour and the idea of a true love marriage charmed both the American and British public, adding to Nelly's fame. Upon her father's death, the famed children's poet Eugene Field wrote a poem entitled Nelly, describing the relief he thought his father must have felt at her visit. And it seems as if now to his heart she were clinging, as she clung in those dear distant years to his knee. And he sees her fair face, and he hears her sweet singing, and Nelly is coming from over the sea. While we don't know very much about Nelly's true relationship with her father, this verse suggests a very warm public perception of her. Nelly had four children of her own while married to Sartress. The family lived in England, but Nelly was said never to have adjusted to English culture. Sartress, meanwhile, went from a charming and functioning drinker to a destructive alcoholic. Sartress' family openly acknowledged the problem and supported Nelly. In 1889, she was granted a divorce, given a large income from her husband's estate, and allowed to return to the US with her children. Sartress died at 42 in 1893, leaving Nelly free to remarry. In 1912, she married Frank Hatch Jones, a lawyer living in Chicago, with whom she stayed until the end of her life. Nelly's story is not simple, and was no doubt made more complex by having every decision made under the public eye. But generally, the public attitude towards her was quite positive, and ultimately the influence and wealth of her family gave her the freedom to make her own decisions, marrying for love and, with the support of respectful in-laws, rescuing herself and her children from a destructive marriage. Fanny Hayes was just 10 when her father became president, and her story is a polar opposite to Nellie's. Although she had six brothers, she was the only daughter. Her mother Lucy was a staunch advocate for women and black people in the US, taking a very active approach to her position as First Lady. Since Lucy kept animals, Fanny lived in the White House with a bird, two dogs, a goat, and the first Siamese cat in the country. Lucy also enlisted young nieces and cousins to help redecorate the house, ensuring a constant community of young women around Fanny, who was mostly kept away from the public eye. In their first year at the White House, Fanny was formally baptised there. She lived in the White House for the full 4 years of her father's term. When it finished, she returned to boarding school, first at Miss Augusta Middleburger's school in Ohio, and then at Miss Porter's school in Connecticut. As an adult, she took on a more public role as an advocate for education and prison reform. Mary Mullie Garfield had a less happy experience at the White House. She was 14 when her father became president in March 1881. Within a couple of months, her mother Lucretia had contracted malaria and was convalescing at the seaside in New Jersey. On the 2nd of July, on his way to visit her, James Garfield was shot by Charles Skeeter at a train station. He initially survived but never recovered, and Mullie lost her father in September. From then on, the family lived on a trust fund, and Mullie continued her education at boarding schools. In 1888, she married Joseph Stanley Brown, who had been a presidential secretary during her father's brief term. The president who followed Garfield was also struck by tragedy, having suddenly lost his wife to pneumonia shortly before he took office. In mourning for her mother, and only 9 years old at the time, his daughter Ellen Arthur, known as Nell, was actively shielded from the press. Her paternal aunt Mary served as White House hostess, while Nell stayed with a governess in New York. Even when she arrived at the White House in 1882, her father kept her shielded. Beyond the press's curiosity about this young girl's tragic story, her father's presidency was marked by controversial issues, as he struggled to enact naval reform, to find compromises on civil rights for black southerners, and to appease Western settlers encroaching upon the land of native tribes. He was not re-elected in 1884, and now returned to New York, maintained a private life, and eventually married. The Cleveland sisters were more widely known. Grover Cleveland was a 47-year-old bachelor when he first entered the White House. His sister Rose acted as hostess for the initial 2 years of his presidency. However, in 1885, his friend's daughter, whose upbringing he had supervised after her father's death, came to visit him in Washington. Frances Folsom was a student at the time. They were soon engaged. They married in the Blue Room at the White House in 1886. He was 49 and she was 21, the youngest First Lady in history, and, despite the unusual match, well-liked by the public. Cleveland lost the 1888 election and the couple moved to New York. In 1891, they had their first child, Ruth, known in the press as Baby Ruth. She quickly became a celebrity child, especially since Cleveland himself never left the public sphere. In 1892, he was re-elected, and the family moved back to the White House. The couple's next child, Esther, was born in 1893. She was the only child of a president to be born in the White House. Her younger sister, Marion, was born in Massachusetts in 1895. In 1904, Ruth contracted diphtheria and died at the age of 12. Esther went on to be married, at age 25, to a British Army captain, William Sidney Bence Bassanquet. They were married at Westminster Abbey, and their daughter Philippa Foot was a famous British philosopher. Marion also lived till adulthood. She married twice and became a community relations director for the Girl Scouts of the United States, working at its headquarters in New York. Their lives took turns no one could have predicted. But all the while, their older sister, known forever as Baby Ruth, was not forgotten. At the turn of the century, the first girl took a more active role in the White House again. Mary Harrison McKee was already 24 when her father Benjamin Harrison became president in 1889. When her mother died 3 years into the presidency, Mary took over as First Lady for the rest of the term. After his presidency, her father began a relationship with her first cousin, another Mary, who was exactly 27 days younger than her. Neither she nor her brother attended the wedding, and she never spoke to her father again. The first family to enter the White House in the 20th century were the Roosevelts. Theodore Roosevelt had 6 children, 2 of whom were girls. The eldest, Alice, was the daughter of Roosevelt's first wife, writer and socialite Alice Hathaway Lee, who died due to kidney failure 2 days after giving birth in February 1884. Alice was a descendant of the Schuyler family of Hamilton fame. Roosevelt gave his daughter to his sister's care until she was 3, reportedly believing it was best for her to grow up elsewhere while he grieved. He rarely mentioned his first wife. His daughter was called Baby Lee rather than being referred to as Alice. She maintained this into adult life, preferring to be called Mrs. L. Roosevelt remarried in 1886 to his childhood family friend Edith Kermit Carew. The couple raised Elle together and had 5 more children, including another daughter, Ethel, born in 1891. Elle's relationship with her stepmother was strained, but in later life, Elle expressed great admiration for her. Elle and Ethel were 17 and 10 when their father became president, and Elle became an instant celebrity. The gown she wore to her social debut in 1902 sparked a trend for a colour that's still known as Alice Blue. Elle routinely rebelled against social expectations of girls, smoking cigarettes in public, staying out late at parties, placing bets with bookies, riding in cars with men, and even keeping a pet boa constrictor called Emily Spinach at the White House. She was also known to take an active role in political affairs, frequently interrupting her father in the Oval Office to voice her opinion. In 1905, alongside her father's Secretary of War, Elle led a delegation to Japan, Hawaii, China, the Philippines, and Korea. It was the largest diplomatic mission to date, with 23 congressmen, 7 senators, and many other diplomats, officials, and businessmen. Elle was 23. Although the mission was politically successful, one of the key press stories that emerged from it was that Elle, while on the ship, had jumped into the swimming pool fully clothed. She enjoyed the opportunity to travel and have some fun, and this was of far more interest to the press than her political abilities. After returning to Washington in December, Elle got engaged to Nicholas Longworth III, a Republican member of the House of Representatives, who had been on the diplomatic mission with her. She wore a blue wedding dress and cut the cake with a sword. Elle did not hide her political disagreements with her husband, but rather appeared on stage with his direct opponent, who was her father's vice presidential candidate. She also had numerous affairs, including a long relationship with Senator William Borah, who who is widely considered to have been the father of her daughter Paulina. Meanwhile, Ethel Roosevelt kept a low profile throughout her father's presidency. She went to school at the National Cathedral, and reportedly found her father's position made it hard for her to make friends. She had her coming out party to make her debut in society at the White House in December 1908, shortly before the end of her father's second term in office, and at just 17, debuting earlier than most girls in order to do so at the White House. She married a surgeon, had four children, and later became a nurse during the World Wars. She also turned the family home, Sagamore Hill, into a National Historic Site, and was one of the first two women to serve as a trustee of the American Museum of Natural History, and was a committed worker for the American Civil Rights Movement. As the younger sister, Ethel was less famous during her time in the White House, but clearly similarly capable and politically engaged. Elle, however, had reached a new peak of celebrity and influence, captivating the press while exercising real agency as part of her father's administration. For many of the first girls, information about their lives is written into articles about their mothers or female relatives, not under their own names, or even those of their male relatives who are presidents. As of yet, these girls who have played important roles in our early political formation have not been much celebrated or written about. But it also speaks volumes about our understanding of gender, work, and history that we discount family life from the biographies of political men. As Eugene Field's poem suggests, the lively, eventful, and powerful stories of the first girls we've met today were no doubt a huge part of these men's lives. The same narrow conceptions of gender that stop us from recognising that role are also those which have limited the power of political women. In this era, women and girls' relationships with men were their only means of engaging with political life. For most of the period, a majority of women were not allowed to vote because of their sex. Girls were not encouraged to speak, write, or participate. But through the soft power of hospitality, culture, and interpersonal connection, they were able to use traditionally feminine activities to influence politics. While some may have seen them as snobbish or shallow, this influence was actually crucial. After all, in the wise words of Beyoncé, persuasion can build a nation. Through the first two centuries, it's clear that daughters and close relatives of presidents played an increasingly concrete role in American political life, until by the turn of the 20th century, the bold Elle Roosevelt was able to lead a diplomatic mission, not only through the strength of her own skill, but from the building momentum of first girls taking on the world. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Be sure to tune in to our next episode on July 20th. In the next half of this mini-series, we'll look at the roles first girls have played in more recent administrations, tackling a developing world press and an increased capacity for women in public life. Finally, please help to support future production of Girl Speak by visiting us at www.girlmuseum.org and clicking donate. Thank you and have a wonderful day.
If you like hearing a fresh, girl-positive perspective on the internet, please support us with a tax-deductible donation easily made on our website. Our music is courtesy of up-and-coming artist Han Av. You can find her SoundCloud link on our website.